There are many ancient legends around the Holy Grail. Often these stories center on the guardian who protects the sacred chalice that Jesus had used at the Last Supper from treasure hunters. So popular are these legends that even Monty Python spent some time on this subject, and perhaps is your only introduction to these legends. But what's interesting to know is that what Monty Python in particular referenced is one of the more famous legends of the Holy Grail. It's about the guardian who guards the Grail for centuries, battling knights and other adventurers, so much so that he is without his two legs and he has lost one arm. He is nearly quadriplegic. And yet, one arm is all he needs to protect the Grail. He's still able to fend off the strongest and the most skilled knights seeking the treasure. One day, a pilgrim enters the woods seeking the Grail. And according to legend, this is the pilgrim who will take possession of the Grail and secure his own salvation. The pilgrim goes into the woods, sword in hand, and meets the ancient guardian. But in that moment, seeing the ancient guardian's ravaged body, the pilgrim puts down the sword, walks forward, looks the ancient guardian in his eye, and asks, "What have you been going through? How are you doing?" No one had ever done that for the ancient guardian, only there to seek their fortune, only there to fight their way in. And so, without force, the pilgrim is the one who takes the Holy Grail, because the ancient guardian sees in him the true light of what the Grail stands for. This is often told as a story of compassion and comedy in terms of Monty Python. But I've been thinking about it more and more the last couple of years of how it is also a story of deep reverence for another human being. One human being recognizing another. It is a virtue that is not mentioned very often, and yet it is at the core of what comes to me as at the heart of Unitarian Universalism. It's the virtue of reverence. This moment of reverence. One human being seeing the humanness in another. It's an amazing little book called The Forgotten Virtue of Reverence. Paul Woodruff, a philosophy professor at the University of Texas, takes up the question of virtue and the role of reverence. Too often, he tells us, it's tied solely to religion and thus nowadays dismissed. It's dismissed because people think, well, it's just merely an aspect of religious behavior. Reverence was recognized, though, by both the ancient Greeks and the Chinese as central to a moral society and moral living. But virtues, what is a virtue? We talk about virtue education. Now it often gets a pejorative notion around it. And if there's any doubt, people often try to find clear definitions of what it might be somewhere else, going back even to Aristotle's Nicomachean Ethics. But if you go back to that, you might find that while Aristotle is rather fabulous, he doesn't define anything very much at all, precisely. And so virtues, reverence, I come to you to speak of the stuff of philosophers, the study of philosophy. Virtues seems too complex of a topic in this world, and a world where we prefer neat categories of right and wrong. It's too messy. And yet, in a time when critical political discussions become so heated, when conversation on different points of view become so angry, revisiting an ethics of virtue perhaps does have a place in our society and in our religious communities to help to illuminate the essence of what is missing in our culture and ourselves, or at least the intentionality of developing our virtues or a virtue of reverence. Paul Woodruff offers that virtues are a strength in a person's character, something that dovetails very nice for Unitarian Universalism, especially in the last century. We talked about being a faith tradition of character and how development of character was central to religious education, and it still is. We just don't always use that language. From the virtue ethics point of view, it presumes that some people act better for the right reasons than other people because of the strength of their moral character. It's not about rules, it's not about laws, although they can function as a set or a standard of laws or rules, but indeed it belongs or rests upon the individual's inner character of whether these rules or different notions of how you're supposed to behave is enacted upon. Virtues are habits of feelings learned over the years through experience. Rules, as we know, can be memorized and then forgotten. A virtue is having the capacity of appropriate emotions at appropriate times and is developed through experience in such a way that inclines those who have it to do the right thing. And you might be thinking this could be culturally shaped, and certainly that's true. We have grown in our understanding what is appropriate or right over the years, understanding more fully what it means to love one another and to act justly. But indeed, it is cultivating that sense in our inner being, generation after generation, and adjusting those definitions as we learn more. So virtues are internalized through the course of living and using them in our living and working together. And the discovery of virtue happens through the experience of it and by repeating the virtuous way of being. And one of the key concepts of any kind of virtue development is having a community, which, this like this one, a religious community, can help cultivate, be a place of growing and learning, especially for our young people, but our adult selves as well, because we need to be reminded. We half forget, we half remember what we're supposed to be doing in this world because we're bombarded by so much information. And that's where we get lost on the whole idea of reverence. Bill Moyers, in an interview of this philosophy professor, asked Dr. Woodruff what he would describe reverence is. He responded, "I think reverence is a capacity for awe in the face of the transcendent." And you might stop there and have an idea of what he means, but listen, it's whatever we human beings did not create. It could be God or justice, truth, nature, beauty. It is a felt sense of our own mortality and our own limitations as human beings, our own tendency to make mistakes. In a faith tradition that talks about possibilities, as I even did in this morning's meditation and prayer, there's also that understanding of where our humanness shapes us and creates boundaries that we can't cross. Or when we do, we lose the sense of not only our own humanness, but the humanity of others. It's realizing the distance between us and the ideals which we see as transcendent. That is the essence of reverence. And it's recognizing that between the time you're born and the time that you die, we'll probably make a number of significant mistakes, guaranteed. I think some of you might have already done this. I know I have. And realizing that this is true of other people as well, that other people make these mistakes, and that we have our common humanity and are all in the same way vulnerable. So as a virtue, reverence is primarily a capacity for having certain feelings at the perhaps appropriate time in the appropriate way, a feelings of awe and respect. And then here's a little catch for some of us. Woodruff uses the word shame. Whoa. But in his mind, it means when we err from the path. This path, a feeling of shame, shakes us into awareness of our behavior. When we forget awe, when we forget respect in that basic humanness of another. Simply put, it's knowing your place as a human being. The principal object of reverence, then, is that which reminds us of our human limitations, whether it's a belief in a transcendent power that helps us, or as a humanist understanding of one's humanity connected to other human beings and our limitations and imperfections. Paul Woodruff describes the need for reverence. He tells us that when people are powerful, they tend to fall into habits of acting as if they were divine. The cliche, of course, we perhaps all know, is power corrupts. But what the Greeks noticed is that it corrupts, power corrupts in a very particular way. You think that you can't go wrong. You think you can't be mistaken. You think because you're not likely to be mistaken, you don't have to listen to anyone. And those are all the signs of a lack of reverence and, in many societies, of tyranny, hubris, an indication of a lack of respect for difference between human beings and what others might call the gods. Relegating reverence to the realm of religion and belief, then, is to miss something in how we can act and move in the world. Indeed, it is the humanist philosophers in ancient Greece and China who promote the virtue of reverence and its centrality to society and an individual's good character. Thucydides, the 5th to 4th century BCE Greek historian, talked about this when he argued, "Gods do not intervene in human affairs from his point of view. He viewed human arrogance and lack of reverence for others as far, far more dangerous than pleasing or not pleasing the gods of ancient Greece." Thus, Woodruff even says, "Reverence has more to do with politics than religion, because reverence is more about human relations than it has to do with relations between human beings and God." But as Unitarian Universalists, that actually brings it right back into us, whether we're theist or humanist or any other range of theological belief. It is about how we act and move with intention in this world, how we act in this community, how we cultivate it, how we grow that, and then act and move out in the greater world. There's so many ways to show reverence. We often think of the really big things. We even think about, like, this morning's story about bowing, which there might have been a gut instinct for some of us, like, no, 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 no. But think about it. There's these small ways that even listening to one another is an act of reverence. Showing up at a bedside of someone who is ill, or that small celebration. Showing up in this world when we're so busy that we feel like, I just can't make the time. But doing that and the showing up is an act of reverence. Again, listening, and that includes our children. Even when our teenager is feeling sullen that day and the answer to, how is your day at school? Fine. That you continue listening and not filling up the space and being with one another. That is reverence. When my son, who's now 12, was 3 and a half, he would talk endlessly about tubes and string and how he was making a vacuum system. He still does this. Now it's computer-oriented, but listening to him, I soon realized, even though I didn't always feel like I had time or I had heard it 500 times, was an act of reverence for this small child. Being a teacher certainly is an act of reverence, listening to our students, helping our students listen to one another. But even having a good meeting at church can be an act of reverence. Voting in a democratic society is an act of reverence, and a sign of appreciation for the system. There's so many ways, little, small, and large, in addition to a big social justice project, that can be seen as acts of reverence. And if we do it in the smallest ways, we tend to engage and bring that reverence more fully into other parts of our lives and the way we are in community. Woodruff explains, part of reverence is recognizing the lines that divide where we can step and what we can touch and what we can do from that where we shouldn't. And when you think about this in the news and terrorism and the gun violence in our cities, in poverty, you can certainly look at that as an interpretation of a deep loss of reverence for one another. Reverence is the glue of society. It creates paths of respect between people with differences, power differences, status differences. Confucius believed the best way to judge a society is by the way the least of the society are treated. The amount of reverence present in a society was his gauge. Reverence. Looking through the world's religions, it's there in so many ways. Whether you're talking about the Buddha seed and seeing the Buddha in others around you, or going back to the roots of Unitarian Universalism, when William Ellery Channing in the 1820s stood in a pulpit and talked about the people in that congregation were made in the image of God, which was a radical concept. Not about sinfulness, not about all the brokenness, although that certainly was a part of his theology, but looking at the people and telling them that each and every one of you have the divine sparks of God within you, and that you should treat one another as if that's true and to begin to believe it. Whether you look at the work of Ralph Waldo Emerson and his reverence for nature, as Alice talked about her chalice reflection, and thinking about when he talked about miracles, and he didn't buy the miracles in the New Testament about Jesus, but what he did buy was the miracle of life itself. Or looking at the famous religious educator Sophia Lyons Foss in the 1950s, a Unitarian, and at Christmas time each year, she would say, "Every night that a child is born is a holy night." The reverence extending to all. Or as the writer Anne Lamott discusses in a famous commencement speech that she gave many years ago about B plus is good enough, talking about people not striving all the time, always trying to do the best, that they would miss life, these young students who are about to graduate, if they kept on pursuing for something more, more wealth, better grades, better this, first ranking, that they would miss the most basic things in life. And she told them that here's what I want you to do, to take care of each other and to feel reverence. She said, a beautiful line in one of Fergan Gledy's old poems is, "I am awaiting the rebirth of wonder." I'm awaiting the rebirth of wonder, another way to reawaken reverence in your lives. And so when it comes to Jack Kornfield and those many, many years ago when he was in a Thailand Buddhist monastery becoming a Buddhist monk, and he had to learn how to bow, which again, for many Westerners, is a very foreign concept and something that people often gut reaction reject. In his learning to do so is this great power of how, maybe not by bowing, but in other significant ways, we can all show reverence. And that sometimes it feels awkward, sometimes it feels ridiculous, but in working and moving through and with intentionality, you too can find a way to live more fully in reverence. Or as Jack Kornfield recalls, so I began to bow to them. Sometimes it was just fine. There were quite a few wise and worthy elders in the community, but sometimes it felt ridiculous. I would encounter some 21-year-old full of hubris who was there only to please his parents or eat better food, and I had to bow because he was ordained 1 week before me. Or I had to bow to the sloppy old rice farmer who chewed the betel nut all the time and never meditated a day in his life, but was part of the farmer's retirement plan. Yet there I was bowing, and because I was in conflict, I sought a way to make it work. Finally, as I prepared yet again for a day of bowing to my elders, I began to look for some worthy aspect of each person I bowed to. I bowed to the wrinkles around the retired farmer's eyes for all the difficulties he had seen and suffered through and triumphed. I bowed to the vitality and the playfulness of the young monks, the incredible possibilities each of their lives held yet ahead of them, and I began to enjoy bowing. Oh, I bowed to my elders. If it moved, I bowed. After some time, bowing became my way, and it was just what I did. And may we all find our own way, and may it be so. Amen.